From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet British detective writer Linda LaPlante, creator of the Emmy Award-winning TV series Prime Suspect. She's just published her first novel, Cold Shoulder, based on a true story about an L.A. woman cop on the skids. Also, concealed necktie cameras, rings with hidden compartments, and transmitters concealed in hotel lamps. We talk with Keith Melton, who collects spy devices from around the world. And a preview of a PBS documentary about mothers who have lost children to AIDS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Senate Democrats are still blocking a vote on the repeal of the 1993 gas tax until Republicans schedule a vote on the minimum wage. Senate Republican leader Bob Dole had wanted a vote yesterday to repeal the tax, but he would have needed unanimous consent from all senators to schedule a quick vote, and the Democrats wouldn't budge. Dole says the GOP will keep trying. Meanwhile, the House Ways and Means Committee's opened hearings on the matter. A spokesman for the American Trucking Association says higher gas prices are costing his industry billions of dollars. He says truckers haven't been able to change their contracts with shippers to make up for the price increase. Euthanasia supporter Dr. Jack Kevorkian, who's being tried on assisted suicide charges, has attended another suicide. The latest one involves a Canadian man with multiple sclerosis. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
The Right to Die Society of Canada says Kevorkian was present when 53-year-old Austin Bastable committed suicide on Monday of this week. That's the same day Kevorkian was on the witness stand testifying in a suburban Detroit courtroom where he's charged with violating common law, which makes assisting in a suicide a felony. Kevorkian's attorney won't confirm the doctor's involvement in Austin Bastable's death. Bastable's disease had robbed him of nearly all of his muscle control. For the past year, he's been lobbying the Canadian government to make assisted suicide legal. His case gained international attention when he created his own website on the internet and called it DeathNet. Details of his suicide have not been released. A family member says Bastable died in Michigan, but it's not known how or where. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
South Africa's Constitutional Assembly adopted a new constitution today. It guarantees equal rights for all and completes the country's post-apartheid transition. Marius Benson reports from Cape Town.
In the parliamentary debate on the constitution, some speakers expressed reservations about the document. The leader of the Afrikaner Freedom Front, General Constant Viljoen, said his members were abstaining in the vote because of concern that the constitution did not sufficiently protect Afrikaner culture. But the final count still easily gave the two-thirds majority needed to adopt the Constitution.
The ayes have it, 421, noes, 2, abstentions, 10. The question has therefore been agreed to.
The final vote ends nearly 2 years of negotiations on South Africa's permanent constitution. For National Public Radio, I'm Marius Benson. In Cape Town.
Stock prices are sharply lower today on worries about high interest rates. The Dow dropped more than 43 points yesterday. Now it's lower by more than 63.5 points at 5,357. Trading is very heavy. The Nasdaq has fallen 19 points to 1,163. This is NPR News. The government is investigating Ford's recent recall of 8 million vehicles with possible ignition switch problems. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration wants to know why hundreds of thousands of other vehicles aren't on the list for recall, too. The ones questioned appear to have a high rate of reported fires from bad switches compared with the vehicles that were actually recalled. Regulators are checking more than 23 million Ford cars and trucks built between 1984 and 1993, all with the same type of ignition switch. There have been about 900 reports of switch fires. Ford says it's confident that it recalled the right vehicles. The latest round of oil for food talks between the United Nations and Iraqi officials has resumed. Baghdad's been banned from selling oil since its 1990 invasion of Kuwait. Linda Fasulo reports.
Under discussion is a Security Council offer to allow Baghdad to sell $2 billion worth of oil over 6 months for much-needed food and medicine. But about 30% of the funds would be withheld to pay war reparations and other costs. Three earlier rounds of talks have yielded no agreement, and after the last round, the U.S. and Britain voiced concern over possible loopholes in a proposed arrangement that they feared could allow Iraq to use food as a political weapon against opponents, including the Kurds, or even buy banned weapons. Despite that, yesterday Iraqi negotiators maintained that they were not bringing any new proposals to the table. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo in New York.
A former Nazi officer is being tried in Italy. Eric Priebke is charged with helping carry out the wartime massacre of 335 civilians outside Rome. Priebke is now 82. He admits he killed two victims, but insists he would have been killed if he had disobeyed orders. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This past Sunday, PBS aired another episode of Prime Suspect, starring Helen Mirren as Detective Superintendent Jane Tennyson. Writer Linda LaPlante is the creator of that series, which has become compulsory viewing for many mystery fans, one of whom is our book critic Maureen Corrigan. Maureen recently talked to Linda LaPlante about Prime Suspect, as well as her recently published detective novel Cold Shoulder. The novel is about a homicide detective who ends up on the skids, homeless, drunk, and selling her body.
Both Lorraine Page, the police detective heroine of Cold Shoulder, and Superintendent Jane Tennyson of Prime Suspect are consummate professional women. They not only battle crime, but the entrenched sexism of their respective police departments. One crucial difference between the two women that I see, however, is that while Jane Tennyson seems to have iron control, Lorraine Page falls apart in a major way in Cold Shoulder. I'd like to ask you to read, if you would, from an early chapter of Cold Shoulder, where we meet Lorraine Page in her present fallen state for the first time.
She had almost died that night. The hit-and-run driver had probably not even seen her. And Lorraine couldn't remember a thing. She'd been taken to the hospital with head injuries. The following weeks were a blur, as she was moved from one charitable organization to another. She had no money left, no medical insurance. Eventually, she was institutionalized and preliminary diagnosed as schizophrenic. To begin with, she was not thought to be an alcoholic because so much else was wrong with her. She had severe abscesses on her shins, a minor venereal disease plus genital herpes, skin abrasions, and was in poor physical condition from lack of decent food. She weighed only 105 pounds and she was over 5'8". She looked like a walking skeleton. Her body was pale, almost bluish, but her hands and face were tanned from living on the street. 80 cigarettes a day had left her with a persistent, heavy cough. She contracted pneumonia, and for 5 days it was doubtful that she would live. When she pulled through, the hallucinations, screaming fits, and vomiting attacks made the doctor suspect severe alcohol withdrawal symptoms.
Thank you. When I first read that passage,
My God, this woman is a cop.
Well, yes, this woman is a cop. And I also thought of what one reviewer said about Jane Tennyson. He praised her mineral coolness. And I thought this character is about as far away from that mineral coolness as you can get. Yeah. I've read that Lorraine's breakdown is modeled on the career of an actual former L.A. policewoman. Could you tell us how you came to hear about her story and describe her experiences for us?
She wasn't actually L.A. Mm-hmm. I met this woman in L.A. Mm-hmm. And I was there promoting, I think, Prime Suspect, actually. And what had happened is that it is known in England that I pay for stories. And so I had been talking about how I gathered material and how I paid people for their stories. And I was staying at a hotel and I got a call from reception and they said, oh, this woman is downstairs to see you. So I thought it was a journalist. So I said, oh, send her up. Fine. And looked down my list to see who I was talking to. And I didn't have her on a list. I didn't have anything on a list. And she came in and, well, I mean, I knew just one look that she wasn't like any journalist that I'd been talking to.
What did she look like?
She had a kind of wig on, which she used to change quite frequently, these wigs. It was very dark, black, wig. She was very badly scarred down one side of her face. But it was her manner. She was quite a big woman. It was just her manner. She was just very pushy. Mm. But she was nervous as well, very nervous. So she said, I know you pay for stories, and I've got a story, and that's why I'm here. So I said, fine. I said, but, you know, it's very difficult for me to tell you, if you're going to tell me for an hour your life story, and at the end of it I'm going to say, look, it's exceedingly boring and I don't want to do it. I've still got your story. So she said, that's cool, yeah, I'm with that. So I said, but if you can tell me in a few short sentences why you think I would want to do your story, then maybe we've got somewhere we can talk. So in a very few, I mean, she just said, listen, I was a cop. I am a homicide officer. I was an alcoholic. I committed a crime whilst I was in the force. I got kicked out and I lost everything and I've been on the streets for 8 years. So, you know, when somebody says it absolutely flat and staring at you, you think, oh, it's a rather good story. I mean, so I said, all right, you've got me hooked. I said, let's start talking. So then she turned around, she said, well, can you wait a minute? I'll go get my lawyer. And he was in the car park. So she came up with this little kind of short, squat guy. And we did a negotiation. We talked. And it was quite tough because, you know, she sort of felt that once she told me her story, that was it. And I said, it's very different to that. I mean, you can tell me, then I have to sift through it, then I've got to work with you. And she said, what do you mean, work with me? She said, I'm a private investigator. I don't work with people. So I said, well, you're going to have to, because you're going to have to take me to the places that you've described. And after a lot of argy-bargy and further negotiations with this little squat guy, she agreed to give me 6 weeks and a certain amount of days in those 6 weeks. And so that was the second stage. And then I said, well, there's a third stage. I said, because when I finish the manuscript, you've got to go through it. She said, what, all of it? So I said, yes. So eventually we agreed.
Has she read Cold Shoulder?
Yes.
In its finished form, yeah.
Yeah, it's in the finished form.
Yeah, yeah.
She's funny about it, actually. Obviously, you know, one has to consider the readers, as I'm constantly told, consider the readers, that, you know, she's a pretty awful woman to begin with. And quite obviously from that passage that I stumbled my way through. Mm. But, you know, that she was tougher, a lot tougher, mm-hmm. A lot sadder. And in many ways, to encourage somebody to have a page turner, you've got to sort of pull out a little bit, mm-hmm. according to my editor, you know. Mm-hmm. My agent once said, my God, who's going to read this? This woman with no teeth. And I said, she doesn't have no teeth. It's just one tooth missing. And she gets it put back. But it is, you know, you have to soften her slightly. So when she read the eventual finished manuscript, I got it back with all these funny notes on. I ain't this cute, underline. And another one was crap over 2 pages. And then another, on the pages she'd write, in very thick red felt tip I'd got, I did not say this. Mm.
I also read that you conducted some first-hand research with L.A. prostitutes in the course of writing Cold Shoulder. Could you describe those research expeditions for us?
Oh, God, that was a classic, because what she used to do, I mean, we didn't get on, you see. This what was so bizarre about this lady, myself. We didn't get on. We argued. She used to call me Miss Lardy-Da. She said, oh, my God, you've got such a Lardy-Da voice, Jace. She was always screaming at my voice, hated the way I spoke. And so on to the prostitution part of her life, when she became a hooker and a crackhead. She said, look, I'll take you to a typical prostitute's dive. She said, a real low-life place, the place that you end up in, like I did. she said, but this one is better than where I was at. So I get to this awful place that's got seven girls behind a kind of window, rather like where I am now, except this is a studio. But there was this window with, you know, those kind of blinds that slatted blinds going mm-hmm. downwards mm-hmm. in colours, like plastic. And all the girls were sitting on these awful old kind of moth-eaten sofa and a chair. And they had all this really appalling underwear, you know, fluffy and pink and stuff. And she said, these are my friends. She said, you know, she's introducing to all these girls. And I was going, hello, how are you? Very kind of you too. And, of course, I'm in the room with the window. And so they said, do you want a cup of tea? So I said, fine, I'll have a cup of tea. So I had a cup of tea. I'm sitting there. And she left, disappeared, which she did frequently on me. So she says, I'll be back later. So she disappears. And I'm sorry this is such a long, rambling story, but it to get to the point, I myself had just taken up tennis and I'd got my tennis underwear on, which are the sort of, you know, your rather thick, stodgy white panties mm-hmm. and a very solid bra. So one of these girls said to me, she said, you'll never know what it feels like, because I'm sitting there with my notebook saying, you know, and how long have you been on the game, so to speak. She said, well, you know what it's to look like. She said, you don't, you know, if you're uncomfortable with us, she said, try sitting in your underwear. I said, no, I don't think I should go to that length. She said, take your frock off. I said, well, all right. So I take my frock off and now they're all laughing at my underwear. And so anyway, the laughter breaks through and they're all telling me about their lives. And I'm sitting there and this curtain keeps opening. These blinds keep going back. And there's this sort of vague male standing hovering. And one or other of the girls, and actually you've got a bleeper, we go, Barbara, would you go to the back, please? Like, you know, a checkout at a supermarket. And I think, oh my God, this is terrible. What am I going to do if somebody picks the one in the white tennis pants? So, and I'm getting into a hot sweat about this, thinking, oh, there's another one. Oh, God. Every time this curtain moved, I thought it was my turn. Well, after about an hour and a half, as these girls have been going in and out, I'm thinking, how come nobody is picking me? And I said to all the girls, I said, do they know my name out there? And she said, yeah, we gave the name. He said, nobody wants you. But it was the odd feeling that I went through of, you know, fear and then, oh, I'm so unattractive.
I love that you admit that because, you know, I think the proper thing to say would be just, oh, I lived in dread of being chosen. But, right, there's that other emotion of pick me,
yes.
That, you know, we all grow up with. And it actually reminds me, there was a scene in Prime Suspect 1, I think, where Jane Tennison is interviewing a group of prostitutes in a pub and prospective customers come over and look them over.
Exactly.
And, yeah. And, I mean, did you have that sense of life imitating art as you were sitting there?
No, I tell you what it is that all the police officers that I've met adore prostitutes. Mm. Not, I'm talking about sexually permissive, mm-hmm. Not that area. But from prostitutes, they get so much information. Mm-hmm. And the police women treat prostitutes with such respect. Approve or disapprove, feel that they do assist society and a certain element in society. And they also give information quite freely about someone or other that they think should be looked at. And so because of that, I think I felt very at ease with these women because mm-hmm. I kind of fantasize, I suppose, that I'm a bit of a cop myself, you know, sure. In the fantasy world. But because I treated them with respect, and they treated me with respect, we ended up as great friends. Mm. And I liked all of those women that I worked with.
Our guest is Linda LaPlante, creator of the TV detective series Prime Suspect and author of the new novel Cold Shoulder. She's speaking with our book critic, Maureen Carrigan. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to detective writer Linda LaPlante, creator of Prime Suspect, in conversation with Fresh Air's book critic Maureen Corrigan.
Cold Shoulder delves into the world of transvestite prostitutes, and that's a world that Jane Tennyson also investigated in Prime Suspect 3. I'm wondering what draws you to that world.
Well, funnily enough, because I was doing the pair at the same time, so really one drew me to the other. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what draws me into the worlds that I go in. I mean, who wants to spend, you know, 2, 3, 4 years of their life visiting some of the worst criminals in British prisons, but I do. Somebody said something to me. It's like one of these transsexuals said something. She said, I wish to God somebody would write it down correctly, what I am. Mm. I'm not a transvestite. I'm a transsexual. Mm. There's difference. And so I didn't know the difference. I didn't know, you know, that I suppose it was just like, so many people, I clumped it all together.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they all must be gay or homosexual. I just didn't know. And gradually, the friendship from... And again, the emotional sadness attached to so many of these people because they had been so confused all their lives just drew me into that world. There was no darkness in there. There's sadness sometimes, but there's a lot of laughs and a lot of great, great, great friends. I mean, sometimes I've been out in very strange places with very odd-looking people, but, I mean, I slap a feather bow around my neck and I'm all right.
What's wonderful to me about both the women detectives you've created is that they're so complex and contradictory. Jane Tennyson is willing, for instance, in Prime Suspect 3 to participate in a cover-up in order to get a promotion. And she's also no particular friend of the other lower-ranked women in the police department, even though she herself has had to deal with sexism. Lorraine is bossy and manipulative and even abusive at times to her friend Rosie in Cold Shoulder. I think we've seen these kind of impure heroes in male detective fiction, and I'm thinking especially about the American hard-boiled form with tough guys like Sam Spade and Mike Hammer. Do you have the sense that you're breaking new ground with these morally compromised women detectives that you're writing about?
I hope so. I would like to, but I think it's just not, you know, trying to break ground with female detectives. It's trying to break ground on all levels. Women have been so badly depicted as most unreal creatures in the fact that you very rarely can look at a book that would have a heroine over 40 that is acceptable as still a woman, even. I mean, you just don't, they don't come up on any level. So that I set out to try and show that there's life after 25 and not necessarily with a perfect background.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, people love realism. They actually love it. And people say, at long last, women looked at Jane Tennyson, that at long last, there's somebody that is identifiable. I mean, we don't all not smoke. We don't all have 44C cup.
Right.
And blonde hair, and we're not all beautiful. Not everybody can have a job and a perfect home life and a career. Not everybody can have a career and a family. And to also make that character as interesting as a male counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very strange to think, do you find Jane Tennyson attractive sexually? Do you find Lorraine Page of Cold Shoulder sexually attractive when you're told she has all these fatal flaws? And I think you do.
Mm-hmm.
If you took, Raymond Chandler's Marlowe, Philip Marlowe, and say, now I'm going to create a hero. He's virtually an alcoholic. He has a cigarette stuck out of his mouth all the time. He treats women like garbage. He never follows from one book to another with the same female. You never say, where was that blonde that you were with the last book that you loved? He's ditched her. He's now on something else. And the way, you know, women are described in the detective novels, I mean, you very rarely hear a woman described in any way attractive who's over 25.
Right.
They're very hard-boiled, hookers, tarts, or they're ingenues of such beauty that take your breath away and his away. So to create a full-blooded female that does smoke, that does drink, is not perfectly formed, and still physically attractive, is rather saying, come into the real world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the most attractive women are flawed. That's why they're so attractive.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from women about Jane Tennyson as a heroine?
Really, it was, I think, the overall show, rather than her specifically.
Mm-hmm.
The approach to it was different throughout. It was the first time, I think, on any television show you had actually been into a mortuary and into a pathology lab. I mean, I know you had, what was that series over here?
Oh, Quincy?
Quincy.
Yes,
but I mean,
the time.
It was always Quincy leaning over and you could hear a little bit of a cut maybe, but you never actually saw the nitty-gritty.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, I had to fight for it too. And I said, no, she is in the mortuary. Let us see her handle that body. And truthfully, I was asked over and over, don't you think she should be more emotional with the dead body? And I said, why? She doesn't know her. Doesn't know her at all. And so it was an approach, really, from all angles that I think I got the most kind of kudos from. And Helen, because of she's such a wonderful actress, rightly got the laurels as a fabulous actress for her performance.
Linda LaPlante is the author of the new detective novel Cold Shoulder and the creator of the TV series Prime Suspect. She spoke with Fresh Air book critic Maureen Carrigan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, umbrella cameras, tie-clip microphones, and other spy gadgets. We talk with Keith Melton, who collects spy devices from around the world. Also, mothers who've become AIDS activists after losing children to the epidemic. We talk with Glenn Hulston about his new PBS documentary, Mother's March. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You know all the spy gadgets that are demonstrated for James Bond at the beginning of each film? If those devices really existed, my guest Keith Melton would probably own them. The late William Colby called him the world's most outstanding collector of intelligence equipment. Melton has traveled around the world, acquiring spy gadgets from World War II and the Cold War. He's the director of the Clandestine Services Museum. His new book, The Ultimate Spy Book, is an illustrated compendium of spy devices, including a belt buckle microphone, underarm tape recorder, burglar alarm evasion kit, radio wristwatch, and a blade concealed in a leather insole. A few days ago, Melton came to our studio with a valise full of his acquisitions. He says that with spy equipment, form follows function, and the function is often to help a spy escape. He showed me a deck of cards designed to help captured English pilots escape in World War II.
England was besieged. She had far more planes than she had the ability to produce trained pilots to fly them. So there was a quest in World War II. How can I repatriate pilots that have been shot down in enemy territory and somehow get them back to England so they can fly and fight again? And the British intelligence set up MI9, which was a part of the overall British intelligence apparatus, specifically with the purpose of establishing escape routes out of France, out of Germany, out of Belgium, anywhere that pilots had been shot down. And they realized that in the prisoner of war camps, there were large numbers of pilots, but they needed a way to escape. And assuming they could get out, they needed probably three things. They needed a compass, and we have items here to conceal compass. But desperately, they needed maps. But how can you get large numbers of maps into a prisoner of war camp? So a gentleman by the name of Charles Fraser Smith had the idea, let's take the maps and let's print them somehow in a deck of cards. And this is a playing card. And inside, if you soak it in water, it opens up.
Oh.
And there is a section of a map. So if you did all 52 cards, you could put together one large map. That map then would be used as the model, and then cartographers in the camp would laboriously hand copy that and provide each person escaping with a map that they could use. And so this is an actual set of the cards from World War II.
Got a couple of, you have a bolt here. It's just a large
In the theory of a dead drop. And a dead drop is a means of impersonal communication so that if a spy has secrets, how does he or she transmit the secrets to the person who can analyze it and do something with it? Because you don't want to hand it personally, because that's how spies are most often caught or compromised or in the act of this communication. So what they do is they select inanimate objects.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Soviets have mastered the idea of going to a bridge, removing a couple of bolts, mm-hmm. taking them back to Moscow, having them machined, then producing one special bolt, and we show this bolt in the book, but it just appears to be a normal bolt.
Right.
You can hold it. It's
Let's
it's,
see if I can
it's a real
yeah,
bolt.
Okay, the top unscrews.
But the top unscrews. And inside this bolt is actually, well, you can see it in there. There is still a KGB message that is inside from when it was loaded back in the late 1960s.
So the idea would be that another spy would come and then unscrew
and
the bolt
it.
On the bridge and retrieve it.
So they would say on the 37th girder on the north side, 3 feet up from the bottom, the third bolt from the left is the special bolt.
You have a kind of dirty little soap dish
soap
there.
Okay. Let's say that you
Looks
have,
used.
That you have photographed some secret documents,
mm-hmm.
and you want to somehow get that film to your handler.
Right.
But you want to ensure that if somehow whoever you give it to transport it is caught, that the counterintelligence won't be able to develop the film because they could trace those documents back to Tracy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. After to Terry or to Sally or to whoever the person that photographed them. So they developed this. Now, if you would open this, if it was charged,
mm-hmm.
a little micro switch would release. A flashbulb would go off inside, and it would incinerate the film that was wrapped around it.
Oh.
Now, but the key is, well, how do you do it? How do we get into it if we want to? We take this large magnet, and I'm going to set this Did you hear the little
switch? I heard
switch?
A little click, yeah.
A little click. The magnet is opening the circuit, so I can in turn reach in, push the detent, then open remove the battery, and you can see that the film is wrapped around the flash bulb.
Wow.
And this is a real piece of tradecraft equipment from the 60s. And things like this, though folks have seen the fictional James Bond movies and read the novels, I think they'll be quite astounded to see that the real world in the real equipment is often far more creative and innovative.
Was this an American or a Soviet spy gadget?
This was actually used by the Russians.
By the Russians.
Yeah.
Now, you got a couple of rings here. Mm-hmm. They just look like ordinary men's rings with stones. One of them has a stone in the middle. One of them doesn't.
Yeah. And unscrew the stone in this one.
Okay. If I can.
It doesn't unscrew.
It's hard to get a grip on.
Well, what happens is it's reverse threaded.
Oh.
So the harder you unscrewed it, the tighter it gets.
Oh, I see. So I was actually tightening it.
Yeah, exactly.
A little trick.
Yeah. And so once you unscrew it, inside is a cavity. Uh-huh. And that cavity could easily conceal a pill.
Right.
It could conceal a microdot or even a compass.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a device that was issued by the British in World War II because they very much needed the ability to transport things. And the other one is the similar concept, except this one, it's flat. It has just a solid brass top. But if you slide the top over, you can see a small working compass is still in the ring.
Wow.
And this was designed for a pilot to wear, so they would always have available to them a compass.
My guest is Keith Melton, author of The Ultimate Spy Book. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Keith Melton. He collects spy gadgets from World War II and the Cold War. You have some disguises in your book. Some of them are basic, like, you know, mustaches and beards.
Yeah.
But there's also this makeup you can use to add wrinkles to your face so that you look much older than you are. How did that work, the makeup?
Interesting. That was actually from the late 30s, to give you an idea. And there was an American director, John Huston, worked for the
film director,
yes,
John Huston.
Yes, worked for the intelligence service, and he brought a lot of the theatrical makeup artists with him, so that literally you could see and track the evolution and the involvement of the theaters and the movie industry, and because the mission is still the same. However, I need to point out very carefully, there is a time factor involved in any form of camouflage or concealment. The Soviets call it maskarova or masquerade, in that if I need to conceal something from you, the length of time that you will be studying it dictates the degree that I will go for the concealment.
Mm-hmm.
If simply I'm going to conceal it from you from a matter of seconds, that I can come up with something that I can set you up by letting you see something I normally carry. It's an innocuous package of cigarettes. It's always the cigarettes I carry. I use this all the time. So after a while, you don't notice it. On the day in question, I take something that looks very close to that has a camera in it. You would never notice it because it's only a matter of seconds that I would have it out, take the picture, put it back in, and then 5 minutes later, I'm pulling out my regular cigarettes. That's totally different from a device that needs to be to withstand public scrutiny and to be examined and there for a long period of time. So the disguise that a person would go to wear simply to appear differently while they're following someone and you need a quick change of clothes so the person doesn't recognize your outfit, that's different from a person who may want to live in a country and have an effective disguise over a period of days or weeks. Totally different degrees. And the one thing you could never hide, there's two things.
Yeah.
You can camouflage most of a person's features, except you can't change the eyes. You can change the color. It's different to do that. And the other thing you'll probably think of this least is your gait, the way that you walk. In fact, the Germans in World War II taught many of their advanced folks that did following to ignore a person's face and ignore elements of their clothing. Learn to track them and follow them by the way they walk.
Let's just go through some historical periods, and maybe you could tell us what the innovations of the period were. World War II, what changed in World War II?
The biggest change in World War II, and it was dramatic because it's really the beginning of, quote, the modern espionage period. Prior to World War II, technology was mission-specific. If you were being sent across the enemy lines in World War I, you perhaps would have been given a cigarette lighter, and a craftsman had individually taken your own lighter and created a container or a concealment cavity in the bottom of it. It would be personal to you. It would be like no other in the world, and you'd use it effectively. Now, in World War II, that changed because it was really, truly the world's first global intelligence war, with a number of people in our intelligence service, in the British services. There was a need not for one individually handcrafted spy radio, but for hundreds or thousands. So the intelligence services turned to mass production and literally would go out and order 3,000 British Type A Mark III suitcase radios. One of the interesting stories, because originally when they were doing things individually, one of the tricks they would use is go down to a port of entry, and as emigres were coming from a foreign country, they would literally either confiscate or buy their luggage and take the luggage and conceal things. Well, as you started to produce thousands of suitcase radios, this just wasn't possible. And so the radios begin, if you knew what to look for, the cases begin to take a distinctive shape and often a distinctive color, either black or brown. And I can still remember a story of a cab driver in World War II who a passenger gets in, and he says, "That's all right, sir. You don't need to tell me where I'm going. I recognize all you fellows because of your distinctive suitcases." Certainly, that is not what was intended.
Was there any unusual gadgetry that was developed for jungle warfare in Vietnam that hadn't been seen before?
You know, there was, but, you know, Vietnam, though there were certainly, it was an intelligence war that was there, it was probably different. That, of course, the South Vietnamese government, in support of our intelligence agencies, did have agents on the ground, but the equipment was never developed in the same ways it did in other areas of the Cold War. One of the items, I'll tell you an item I've looked for years that was there. Have you ever heard of the elephant transmitter?
Mm-mm.
This was a piece of equipment. As we were tracking items coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail,
mm-hmm.
we had mountain yards, indigenous native people there that were on the American payroll to go and monitor the Ho Chi Minh Trail. But because they didn't speak our language, they didn't read and write, they needed an effective way. So someone designed a metal box with buttons, and above each button there would be a picture. One picture would be an elephant, and there would be a button. There'd be a bicycle, there'd be a button. There'd be a truck, there'd be a button. There would be a tank, and there'd be a button. And they would go to the Ho Chi Minh Trail, lay up in a hide, make sure they could observe, and literally, as a truck went by, they'd push the button beneath the truck symbol. And periodically, a spy plane would fly overhead and would interrogate this little transmitter, and it would beam up the information. They'd record it, take it back, and analyze it. I've never been able to find one of the elephant transmitters, though I know they exist.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very kind.
Keith Milton collects spy devices, and he's the author of The Ultimate Spy Book.
Thank you.
You've probably heard plenty of stories about people with AIDS who felt shut out by their families. But the opposite is sometimes true. Many parents have become even closer to their children after they were diagnosed with AIDS. Some of those parents have even become AIDS activists. Tonight, PBS premieres a new documentary called Mother's March about five mothers who became activists after losing children to AIDS. The producer is my guest, Glenn Halston. He told me how he got the idea for this documentary.
My initial proposal was about parents who've lost their children to AIDS. And it was a very quiet program, about very mournful, and I imagined, you know, syrupy music, and I don't know where I was headed with that. But then when I first started to meet women, and it was only women who I met who were activists who had lost their children, I began to think that here is a program that's alive, and it suddenly clicked for me.
You know, it's interesting. So many of the stories that you hear are the opposite of the stories that you show in your movie. You so often hear stories about parents who are so embarrassed, so ashamed of their child who has AIDS, and they won't confide in friends. They don't want the people in the neighborhood to know. And this is kind of the opposite. This is where parents are so moved to action by watching their child die that they're transformed by it.
I think that's true. I do think that some of the women in the programs had that initial reaction. The initial reaction, Marty Gillen talks about wanting to close up her house, you know, on the main line and seal herself up and let no one know. But then I think the energies and the anger and the sadness and the grief just become so fertile in their body. Just they have to find some channel to have those energies transferred. And so they start looking for ways. Each woman found her own way of, it's very organic, a very organic process, found her own niche, a way of expressing her anger and grief. So they have been transformed. I mean, Beverly Rotter says that she would never want to go back to what it was. But she says that her daughter taught her. When her daughter became sick, she moved home, Iris de la Cruz. And it was during that reunion of mother-child that Beverly was exposed to different parts of the world. And that, I think when her daughter moved home, that was the beginning of her activism in that case.
One of the mothers who you filmed works at a hotline.
Yeah.
And there's an 800 number of people from all over the country call. What was that experience like, being there and hearing these calls coming in, hearing how she handled them?
Well, the hotline, Mothers on the Hotline originated because the PWAC, the People with AIDS Coalition in New York, is the organization. And they had a hotline, an 800 hotline, and they found themselves getting a lot of calls from women who were going through experience, like the mothers in the program. And so they assigned up some mothers to answer the phone. And that was a long day. It was a remarkable day. We had been taping for a couple of hours, and there had been many calls from different parts of the country. Practical things. My son has the night sweats. When Barbara then can say, Barbara Skinner is the mother who answered the phone that day. You know, she said, she reaches back from her experience and says, oh, you know, cotton sheets are the very practical things. If your son has night sweats, change the clothes off and don't let him sit in a sweaty thing. But then by the end of the day, right before we were going to pack up, she received this one call from a woman who had found out that afternoon that her son was diagnosed with AIDS. And apparently the son had come home and was seeking comfort in her arms. And it was very emotional. It was very moving. And filming that was, it was one of those moments where everything else went away. And you could only focus on her words. And I was visually focusing just on her lips at the receiving end of the phone, you know. And to hear how steadily she handled the call and how she, all the calls, she really steers them, maneuvers them. And she makes a decision whether or not to share, whether or not her son has passed away, depending on the person calling and what their needs are, because she doesn't want to scare the person. But she's a realist. You know, she speaks very frankly. And it was an inspiring time to be with her.
Hi, I'm back.
Where are you calling from?
How you doing? Yeah. You have a long way to go here. This is your first day. You know, you feel like you're all dying, and you're not. Well, think about it this way. What if he needed you and you died? There's that, too. I know how you feel. I felt like that when I heard about my son. I thought, why am I here to be with this? I don't want to be. I don't want to be here and watch this happen to my son. But then you start, your mind will start to change, and you'll suddenly be very careful crossing the street because you'll want to be around so you can help. Hold on, don't go away.
I think an interesting thing about your program is that a lot of viewers probably would feel very distanced from the people who had died of AIDS. I mean, one of the people who died of AIDS got it through intravenous drugs. And that's going to alienate a lot of people. You know, there's gay people who died of AIDS, who you talk about on the program. That would alienate a lot of people. When you look at the mothers, these are mothers who a lot of mothers watching television would feel, that's me.
Yeah.
That's my friend. That's my neighbor. That's me. I'm not sure what my question is, but...
But it does bring up the biggest lesson that I learned throughout this production was from each of the mothers. When I first did pre-interviewing and I would meet and I went and met these women, mm-hmm. on the top of my list of questions was, how did your child get AIDS?
Mm-hmm.
And through the interview process and getting to know these women, I realized that that's not the most important question at all. That's the least important question. The most important question now is, what are we going to do about it? And how are we going to stop this, you know, the spread of the disease and increase education? I mean, that's what I learned from these women, is that it's not important. And they didn't make any judgments whatsoever. And all the lifestyles of the children are very different from the lifestyles of the parents. But there weren't judgments made. There was this unconditional love and support for the child.
My guest is Glenn Holston. His documentary, Mother's March, airs tonight on many public television stations. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Back with Glenn Holston, his documentary Mother's March is about mothers who have become AIDS activists after losing children to AIDS. What else surprised you about the mothers?
What I appreciate and what surprised me is the fact that their complete honesty and their complete willingness to expose themselves and their families to a public television audience. And that's something I take very seriously, is when I bring in a camera into somebody's home, the fact that they understand the repercussions of that, who's going to receive the message and who's going to hear and how that's going to affect their lives. And so that's why the pre-production part where I meet with people and explain to them the project, I find so important.
Mm-hmm.
Even I had asked Beverly Ryder to look for pictures of her daughter as a young girl, and she hadn't done that since her daughter had died. So this documentary caused her to go through that sort of opening up again.
Mm-hmm.
And that I found terribly inspiring, too. There was a willingness, because the will to educate and make change is stronger than their emotion, their grieving. Somehow that the loss is fueling this energy, this fire within each one of them. And another thing that I realized was that each woman, you know, there's a... Beverly is an activist who marches and stands in front of the White House, mobilizes women to stand in front of the White House with pictures. Dimitra Patukas is a woman who has a quiet activism, which I think is just as important as the woman who can mobilize, you know, armies. And that was something that I learned, that an activist doesn't have to be, this person out in the forefront. The quiet activism is almost as strong. When we were shooting at Dimitra's house, the day of our interview, she got a call from a friend whose child had died from AIDS and didn't want the world to know that it was AIDS. It was terribly poetic, because I was interviewing Dimitra's husband as she got this call, and she was consoling and trying to not tell this woman what to do, but by her own personal experience, by her own personal demonstration of her willingness to be open about the her relationship with her son and how he died, she was demonstrating to this other woman that, you know, it's not, you don't have to keep it quiet.
If you've lost friends to AIDS, have you maintained any kind of relationship with their parents? I mean, have you gotten to know the parents of friends in a different way as the friend was sick and everybody was kind of coming together to help?
No, not in my personal experience, I haven't.
Is that because the parents haven't been around at the same time as the friends? Or
probably because of the friends and parents have lived
far apart. And in the mothers in your program, they all live close to...
Or they moved home.
Or their children moved home.
Which I think is a remarkable thing for a parent to live through, to raise someone, see them leave home, then have them come back home and die. That to me is a journey of mythic proportions, an emotional upheaval that I cannot even imagine. But that was one of the things that attracted me so much to the program.
For the child, too, I think that's an incredible journey. A really ambiguous one in some senses.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because I think sometimes people would prefer to live where they established their new homes and their new communities, but they can't.
Yeah. One of the most, Mrs. Patukas' son would say, you know, it's terrible. You have to wash me like this. I can't get off the couch. And she says, you know, he returned to the state that he came into the world in. And that, again, is terribly moving to me, that there was this... And she said, I'm a mother. I don't mind. That's what a mother does. And that struck me as very strong and very sort of, you know, the sweeping human saga right here in the living room. The whole life and death comes back to the living room.
Well, Glenn, thanks a lot for talking
Terry,
with
thank
us.
Thank you.
Glenn Holston, his documentary Mother's March, will be shown tonight on many public television stations. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Al Banks, and Dan Lachlan. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.